And now... No, no, wait, wait. A special broadcast for our blind and print-impaired listeners. Not yet. The North Carolina Reading Service now presents... It's the Indie Week. It's read by John Federson. And this issue, dated October the 6th, 2022. Our musical guests today, who should still be playing, hint, hint. Thank you, folks. The musical guests, the Bless Their Hearts musical duet, who may be with us at the end of the show. To start, we'll go to IndieWeek.com, which publishes some stories that are not in the print edition. And this first one, Gerrymandering Debate Returns to NC Supreme Court. They wrestled once again, writes Keelan Lyons, with the issues of redistricting and gerrymandering in a case in which Republican lawmakers contend they should be allowed to draw maps however they choose, regardless of whether they dilute the voting power of people casting a ballot in favor of Democrats. The North Carolina Supreme Court wrestled once again with the issues of these gerrymandering case, and the court, Philip Strzok, the lawyer representing the GOP, argued the court should defer to the General Assembly when it makes these policy decisions, unless they make obviously wrong decisions. It's not the first time the state Supreme Court has heard the case. In just last February, the justices ordered the legislature to redraw congressional, state house, and state senate districts that the majority of that court ruled were unconstitutional because they impermissibly weakened votes for Democrats and favored Republican candidates. The court's three Republican justices disagreed and dissented. The court's opinion did not explicitly lay out how to draw the maps, but mentioned five different metrics used by redistricting experts and said some combination of those would pass constitutional muster. Later that month, a panel of Superior Court judges replaced the Republican-drawn map for the state's congressional districts with its own. The panel also decided that the state, House, and Senate plans that the legislature adopted met the constitutional standards set by the state Supreme Court. Voters backed by the National Redistricting Foundation, who sued over the Republican-controlled gerrymandered districts, argued before the court that the legislature still didn't draw the maps correctly and the maps should be thrown out. Strzok said the General Assembly erred on the side of caution in redrawing the maps, trying to both comply with the order and to draw maps that would get enough votes from lawmakers to pass. Strzok said the trial court should have deferred to those judgments that it made, which it did, in part, but then inexplicably didn't apply that to the congressional map. Why? We don't know, because the trial court didn't explain why it was rejecting one map over the other. Elizabeth Theodore, attorney for the plaintiffs, accused Republicans of asking the court to let them cherry-pick which metrics they use when drawing maps and ignore all other evidence that their maps are discriminatory. She said it's actually not that hard to pass a map that's fair. It's obvious that these maps weren't. They passed on a party vote line. The problem isn't that the General Assembly can't not gerrymander. It can. The problem is that these remedial maps, both the congressional and Senate, were dramatically skewed to favor Republicans. She asked the court to strike down the congressional and Senate maps, arguing that the Senate map yields unfair outcomes for Democrats. She said, when the Republicans get 55% of the vote in the Senate map, they get 33 seats, which is a supermajority. And when the Democrats get 55% of the vote, they only get 28 seats. Strzok, meanwhile, said that what was ostensibly, quote, simple math to comply with the metrics set forth by the Supreme Court turned out to be a lot more complicated. He said there were thousands and thousands of ways to calculate two specific metrics mentioned by the court, measures on which the court gave specific guidance on what threshold must be hit to satisfy the requirements. This is no way to conduct constitutional analysis, Strzok said. Hillary Klein, an attorney representing Common Cause, said it would have been easy for legislators to draw a map that would have scored better on partisan metrics without getting rid of neutral criteria for redistricting. Plus, Klein said, the court's past ruling did not fix the destruction of crossover districts, where some majority voter ballots cross over with racial minorities to elect the minority preferred candidate. Klein said the maps intentionally destroyed two crossover districts in Senate District 4 and House District 1. Klein said when legislatures went back to draft remedial maps where they had statewide discretion to bring those maps into partisan compliance, they purposely chose to redraw other areas of the state while ensuring the destruction of functioning crossover districts in eastern North Carolina. Legislators destroyed these crossover districts, even though preserving them would have helped bring the map into partisan compliance. She added, in order to give full force and effect to the Supreme Court's February opinion, the justices must strike down both the remedial House and Senate maps. Justice requires it, she said. Strzok concluded his rebuttal by asking the justices to dismiss the appeal on the congressional maps and affirm the trial court's approval of the legislative plans. Otherwise, he warned, quote, this court is barreling into the political wilderness where the legislative authority to redistrict will be transferred from the legislature to the courts. The U.S. Supreme Court is currently considering a related case, Moore versus Harper, in which Republican legislators argue that state courts shouldn't even be allowed to assess the General Assembly's decision on congressional elections and rule that they are unconstitutional. Tuesday's arguments marked the second time this week that the state Supreme Court heard arguments on a case involving elections. On Monday, the justices heard an appeal of a lower court decision from 2021 that struck down a state law requiring a photo ID to vote. Superior Court judges ruled in a 2-1 decision last year that the law unconstitutionally targeted African-American voters and put a greater burden on them than their white counterparts. Gerrymandering and voting rights were also the subject of debate at the United States Supreme Court on Tuesday, where justices heard arguments in Merrill v. Milligan, a case brought by civil rights groups challenging the congressional district map in Alabama. The court is expected to hear arguments in Moore v. Harper late this fall or early in 2023. Next, by Akia Dillon, this originally published on Ninth Street Journal. Durham Initiative seeks to understand and repair communities harmed by violence. On September 14th, just before 2 p.m., courtroom 7D buzzes. Attorneys chatter in the well. Family members, religious leaders, local organizers share smiles in the gallery. Today, those gathered at the Durham County Courthouse bear witness to Donald Floyd Jr.'s journey toward restorative justice, an unlikely tale of accountability and making amends. In 2016, Donald Fields Jr., now 30, was arrested and charged with voluntary manslaughter. Amid an argument in the family home, he fatally stabbed his father, Donald Fields Sr., who was 54. 3 months ago, after serving almost 6 years in prison, Fields was released on a newly reduced bond. He entered a pretrial release agreement with the state. Restorative Justice Durham, an initiative of the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham, seeks to holistically understand and repair communities harmed by wrongdoing or violence. All affected parties, including victims, offenders, community members, and law enforcement, create a plan to make things right. Here, offenders are allowed to take responsibility for their actions and grow. Today, Fields and his attorney, Matthew Cook, are at the defense table. Fields, dressed in a fitted white polo shirt, sits straight and tall. Prosecutor Kendra Montgomery Blinn outlines the conditions of Fields' release. Over 9 months, Fields must, among other things, obey the law, comply with mental health treatment, and respect the boundaries of his father's family members. If he meets these conditions, Fields will not serve any more time. It's been 3 months, and for the most part, Fields has stayed true to the pact. He has even completed cognitive behavioral intervention programs ahead of schedule. He is still looking for a job. Blinn summons Reverend Annette Love from the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham. Love, who appears to be in her 50s, also wears white. Over 3 months, she has mentored Fields. She says, he says, I am like a second mother to him. He wants to show the community that he can be a productive citizen after all this has happened. He just made a bad decision. I'm grateful that he has been able to go through this process. Letitia Soria Thomas represents Jubilee Home, which provides housing to formerly incarcerated men. She praises Fields' adjustment to the transition home. Quote, from day one, he's been a model resident. He consistently builds healthy, well-rounded relationship with other home members. He shows up caring about the environment that he is in. She notes that Jubilee Home is in historic Haiti, a neighborhood that, though rich in culture and community, is burdened by drug trafficking, prostitution, and violent crime. Still, she insists that she has no concern about Fields' ability to stay out of trouble. As the witnesses speak, Fields stares straight ahead. Alexander Fields, his uncle, goes last. He represents the victim's family and their capacity for forgiveness. And he says, thank you for giving my nephew a second chance. I can see the progress. Recently, Donald told me, I'm grateful for the chance to breathe clean air. He was grateful for being able to be bitten by a bug. Once the testimonies conclude, Judge Ofaluda directly addresses Donald Fields. The judge is the first and only person to do so throughout the 20-minute hearing. Ofaluda permits the removal of the defendant's electronic monitor, a reward for good behavior. Then behind his thin-framed glasses, his eyes fix on Fields. And he says, when we talk about forgiveness, it does my heart good when someone has done everything you have. I don't get to hear this very often. So thank you, Mr. Fields, and keep up the good work, sir. This gives me a reason to get up in the morning. The judge asks if Cook, Fields' attorney, has any final comments. Fields leans into Cook's shoulder and whispers, Mr. Fields requests permission to travel to Clayton and attend church with his father's family on Thanksgiving and Christmas, Cook says. The room pauses while Montgomery Blinn confers with the Fields family seated behind her. They welcome the motion. Moving to Raleigh news from Jasmine Gallup. One Wake, a community group advocating for property tax relief, is holding a forum today for Raleigh mayoral and city council candidates. Nearly every candidate will gather to discuss affordable housing in this forum. The forum takes place a month before midterm elections. And it will include mayoral candidates Mary Ann Baldwin, Terrence Ruth, and DeQuanta Copeland, as well as 19 candidates for the city council. Four candidates are not attending: Whitney Hill, District A; Jacob Lowerblatt, District B; Todd Kennedy in District D; and David Knight, the incumbent, in District E. One Wake has been fighting for property tax relief for Raleigh homeowners for more than a year. As home values increase, property taxes for long-term residents have also skyrocketed, creating a burden for some low-income homeowners. Historically, African-American neighborhoods, which are now gentrifying, have been particularly hard hit. Since 2016, homeowners in southeast Raleigh have seen property taxes rise between 65 and 150%. Wake County Manager David Ellis says the county commission is considering creating a new assistant program proposed by One Wake, dubbed the Homeowner Care Fund. A $5 million pilot program is a board priority for next year's budget, he says. The county is also considering budget increases for a crisis intervention program, which provides heating and cooling assistance. An increase $1 million would serve an additional 1,600 households. A home repair program, an increase of $1.5 million, would serve another 15 households. And the affordable home development program, an increase of $1.5 million, would serve another 15 households. And this week, One Wake will ask Raleigh City Council candidates if they plan to make an equivalent investment in housing cost relief if elected to office. A One Wake news release stated, participating homeowners see this effort as a continuation of their parents' civil rights struggles in Raleigh and across Wake County. The forum is at 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. and it's at the St. Ambrose Episcopal Church, the address 813 Darby Street in Raleigh. Now Jane Porter, North Carolina News, Workers Wronged. Congressman Ted Budd is fond of touting his hard work for family farms and businesses on the campaign trail. Last year, the Washington Post reported on allegations that the Budds, including Ted, ripped off American farmers by improperly transferring millions of dollars in assets to themselves just before an agriculture business, of which Budd patriarch Richard Budd was CEO, went bankrupt. Now, newly surfaced court documents reviewed by the Indy show that the Budds family's janitorial business has a track record of allegedly treating its workers as poorly as the farmers, who say they lost their shirts. As the Budd Group grew into a multi-state conglomerate with thousands of employees, currently worth an estimated $100 million, employees at the company dating back more than 20 years complained of discriminatory working conditions and workplace violations, including wrongful termination, sexual harassment, racial discrimination, and safety breaches. Many of these allegations overlap with the U.S. Senate candidate's tenure on the Budd Group as an executive and owner, including a total of 13 occupational safety and health violations between 1998 and 2004 that racked up thousands of dollars in fines. Budd's campaign did not respond to the Indy's request for an interview. Mary B. McMillan, the president of the North Carolina branch of the AFL-CIO, the largest federation of workers' unions in the nation, says, "I'm concerned any time I see there's a company that has multiple lawsuits from employees claiming unsafe working conditions, harassment, discrimination, wage theft, and misclassification. It basically covers the whole gamut of things you don't want to see happen to workers." The Budd Group, according to its website, had its origins in 1963 when Budd's father Richard bought, quote, a struggling janitorial supply company in Winston-Salem. The company expanded to offering janitorial, maintenance, and landscaping services and began operating in new markets with a presence today in 8 states across the Southeast, including South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. With a bachelor's degree from Appalachian State and a master of theology from the Dallas Theological Seminary, Ted Budd joined the Budd Group in 1998, according to his LinkedIn page, or in 1999, as the Washington Post reported, as the Director of Employee and Community Relations. In 2000, Budd became Regional Vice President of the company and ran its operations in Charlotte. The next year, Budd and his brother, Joe Budd, purchased the business from their father, and Joe is currently the company's CEO. Ted Budd's LinkedIn account states that for 7 years since he started at the company, he worked to recruit talent in Charlotte and lead a team in Florida that reduced worker comp claims from over $500,000 to less than $10,000 in 1 year. In 1998, Bud's first year with the company, per LinkedIn, a former employee, Kevin Tong, who had been hired in June of the same year, alleged he was fired after he complained of repeated incidents of racism by his supervisor. Court documents state the Bud Group hired Tong as a lieutenant security officer at what was then known as the Pinellas Square Mall in Pinellas Park, Florida. Tong, of Vietnamese origin, alleged in a lawsuit against the company that he endured repeated and constant racial and national origin-based slurs from his supervisor and branch managers, including the manager referring to Tong repeatedly as a stupid Charlie and making references to the Vietnam War using phrases such as fire in the hole. In August of that year, Tong was fired. His complaint initially alleged wrongful termination and the creation of a hostile work environment and sought $15,000 in damages. Later, after the Bud Group answered the suit and acknowledged Tong's and his supervisor's employment with the company but denied all of the complaints, Tong added a third count to his complaint that alleged racial discrimination under the Civil Rights Act. Meanwhile, Tong was diagnosed with an aggressive form of brain cancer that caused delays in the filings while Tong sought treatments. According to court documents, the Bud Group's legal team moved to have the civil rights section of the lawsuit dismissed due to the delays while Tong received cancer treatment. The company was overruled. Ultimately, the case was settled in mediation in 2000. The details of the settlement are unknown. Tong died in 2001. A decade later, in 2011, employee Perry Davis, who worked as a police officer before joining the Bud Group's Charlotte office as an operations manager, sued the company for wrongful termination. In court documents, he alleged he was praised for doing an excellent job and meeting all the company's expectations. One morning, Davis woke up with an uncontrollably shaking right hand. At the same time, he was also dealing with short-term memory loss. And the court documents state, company management made jokes regarding his memory, sometimes stating to other employees, "You're playing Perry, now you can't remember." Davis reported the shaking to the company and took leave to undergo medical testing, suspecting it might be Parkinson's disease. He continued to work and was reassured by company officials not to worry about his job. A few weeks later, Davis received a phone call to tell him he was fired because the company, quote, could not accommodate his disability, citing his inability to do client and site visits. Davis stated he never told the company he was unable to meet clients or site visits. Davis was later diagnosed with a permanent neurological condition. He sued the Bud Group under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the complaint was settled out of court. It's not clear when Ted Budd divested of his ownership in the Budd Group. He downplayed his involvement with the company when it was reported that, in 2020, the Budd Group received a $10 million paycheck protection loan, the maximum available. According to Budd's LinkedIn, he was studying for an MBA at Wake Forest University in 2007 and 8. He no longer listed himself as an owner of the company in 2015 before his initial run for Congress. But the Bud Group's mistreatment of workers continued during Ted Budd's tenure at the company and after he left. In 2008, Jeremy Thibault, a former site supervisor who worked for the Bud Group in Hillsborough County, Florida for 4 years, sued the company for nonpayment of wages after working in excess of 4 hours per week throughout his respective employment. The Bud Group eventually settled with Thibault for $8,700. In 2013, Julia McIntyre filed a federal lawsuit against the Bud Group for employment discrimination on the basis of sex under the Equal Opportunity Act. after she allegedly was sexually harassed by five of her male colleagues, including a district manager. After McIntyre reported the harassment, she stated she was removed from the work schedule and ultimately fired. The Bud Group, in response, says it wasn't aware of McIntyre's complaints, denied she faced a hostile work environment, and said she didn't complain of harassment to the right person. The court dismissed McIntyre's complaint. In a 2016 case similar to Perry Davis's, Tommy Gates Gein, who went on medical leave in 2014 for chronic conditions, sued Bud Group for violating the Family and Medical Leave Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act for firing her after she was unable to return to work. A supervisor had refused to give her FMLA paperwork, and Gates Gein stated she was told her job was secure. Court documents suggest Gates Gein reached a settlement with the Bud Group in mediation. In 2017, Donald Jones, a landscaper with Bud Group, from 2011 to 16, sued the company under the Civil Rights Act after he was allegedly subjected to, quote, a racially hostile work environment, as well as harassment based on his religion from the supervisors of his landscaping crew. One of the supervisors, quote, repeatedly used the N-word to African-American employees, said that black people were no good and they should go back to Africa, and that black people were stupid mother blanks, state court documents. The supervisor often referred to African-American employees as monkeys and animals. They would point to animals as the crews were riding to work and compare them to the black crew members. They chased crew members with landscaping tools, according to the documents, and belittled them for believing in Jesus Christ. The crew was told if they didn't like the jokes and harassment, they could quit. The Bud Group acknowledged the racism for one of the supervisors, including use of the N-word, and that a supervisor chased a black worker with a shovel. The company settled with Jones in mediation for an undisclosed amount. McMillan, the AFL-CIO president, notes that Bud doesn't have a strong record of supporting workers in Congress. He voted against bills that would specifically help working people, including the 2020 stimulus bill and the Inflation Reduction Act. Bud has said he doesn't support raising the minimum wage. But, McMillan says, with Bud working in management at the Bud Group, he, quote, clearly should have been aware of the issues and should have rectified the issues before this all happened. This takes it to a whole new level to see that his family's company so many times seemed to fail workers. I'm certainly concerned to see this at a company that's affiliated with somebody who could potentially be a United States senator. Well, let's move on to another a long column featuring Ted Budd by Lena Geller, The Gunslinger and the Judge. How do you write a profile of a man who wants to be a U.S. senator but doesn't want to talk to you? First, you go to his gun store. During my hour-long drive to Pro Shots, a gun store and indoor shooting range in rural Hall, North Carolina, owned by Republican U.S. Congressman Ted Budd, I listened to most of the store's short-lived 27 podcasts, a structureless jabberfest where four employees discussed their vast firearm collections and the limitations of concealed carry permits. State law prohibits carrying concealed firearms in schools, which is a, quote, sticky wicket for gun owners with kids, one employee says in the second episode. I would be curious to know whether North Carolina defines a daycare as an educational facility. In another episode, an employee names his prized possession as a CZ-27 pistol used by a German officer in World War II, complete with all the stamps and markings. A quick Google search of the model confirms that markings include a swastika. My ears are pricked for mentions of Bud, a three-term congressman who's running against Democrat Sherry Beasley in the race to replace retiring Republican North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, but no one says anything about him, a harbinger for the rest of my reporting. Backed by former President Donald Trump, Bud secured a hefty 59% of the vote in May's Republican primary for U.S. Senate indicating that a chunk of North Carolinians still have a soft spot for Trump-era extremism. Bud easily triumphed over the primary's biggest name and fundraiser, former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, and his win cast shade on Burr, who voted to convict Trump in the former president's second impeachment trial. In the months since the primary, Bud, who has represented a congressional district in central North Carolina since riding in the Trump wave in 2016, has been neck and neck with his opponent in the polls. In efforts to broaden this gap and appeal to a wider base, the congressman has tried to distance himself from Trump and dilute his populist messaging. Its ads, which previously touted Trump's endorsement and labeled immigrants as criminals and drug smugglers, now show him sandwiched between grocery store carts, vowing to fight inflation. His website paints him as a North Carolina-born, farm-raised, Eagle Scout badge, small business owner who loves God and hates Joe Biden. "I pledge to you," his site reads, "I will work for everyday families, not the elite or political insiders." But the receipts tell a different story. In July, a day after accepting the maximum campaign contribution from big oil PAC Continental Resources, Bud voted against legislation that would lower gas prices and protect consumers from price gouging by big oil companies. Similar in 2019, Bud voted against lowering consumer drug prices just days after taking thousands of dollars from two big pharma PACs. In perhaps the most glaring display of corruption, Bud has voted in support of corporate special interests after taking $30,000 worth of trips on their dime, traveling to places like Miami, Palm Beach, and Oslo, Norway, and staying in $900-a-night luxury resorts. Bud's critic accused him of being a hypocrite. He promotes himself as an ally to farmers, but made millions off a family business scheme that bankrupted the company Agribiotech and cost farmers $50 million in losses. He says he supports service members, but has voted against expanding health care for veterans. Despite demanding that Governor Roy Cooper do more to explain how those in positions of power are acting proactively to protect children, Bud has passed up opportunities to address child abuse time and again, voting against bills that would have provided a composite $890 million in funding for child abuse prevention services. And for all his efforts to come off as a Constitution-abiding everyman, Bud has refused to say whether he accepts the results of the 2020 presidential election, called the January 6th insurrection just patriots standing up, and recently co-sponsored a bill that would impose a national ban on abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. When I pull up to ProShots, I notice the similarities between the store and its owners. Like Bud, ProShots is clinical and unassuming, a multi-million-dollar operation doing its best to blend in with a Family Dollar and a Tractor Supply store. Besides a large sign that says, "Helping our community responsibly enjoy firearms," the store's walls are mostly adorned with shotguns, assault rifles, and accessories, like noise-canceling earmuffs for babies and kids. I don't know anything about guns, so I ask a salesman named Gabriel to confirm the weapons I see are indeed assault rifles. "They're totally new," he says. "They never assaulted anybody." Between March 18th and August 2020, multiple firearms, ammunition, and gun accessories were stolen from ProShots. And in January 2019, a man died by suicide while using the store's indoor range. I ask Gabriel whether the store has revamped its security system since those incidents. "We put all the ammo back here," he says, gesturing behind the register. Brightly colored boxes of bullets are stacked in neat rows. "That makes it so we have to get it to customers, and we've added more security." When I ask him what Bud is like, he says he can't comment and darts off. Another employee tells me the store's media guy has instructed workers not to talk about Bud with reporters. Bud and his campaign did not respond to multiple requests for comments for this story, and nearly all my other attempts to interview folks who know Bud, fellow Congress members mostly, also fall flat, though I am able to reach Chris Beckman, a former ProShots marketing manager, over the phone. Working for Ted was actually a lot of fun, says Beckman, who worked at Proshots between 2015 and 18 and went to the same church as Bud for a number of years. As a gun store owner, Bud emphasized education and safety and was receptive to his employees' feedback, according to Beckman. On the topic of safety, it's worth noting that ProShot's website advertises an insurance provider that supports gun owners facing domestic violence charges. He kind of surprised us when he ran for Congress, says Beckman, but it was great. He saw a really great opportunity to do something beyond what he was doing, and I believe he had the right mindset for it at the time. But Beckman, the one person I reached who knows Bud personally, isn't sure whether he's voting for him in November. He hasn't spent time reviewing Bud's stances on, quote, a few key issues that would impact his family, but he won't elaborate further. According to Carter Wren, a longtime Republican political strategist in North Carolina, the majority of voters will be thinking about national issues, primarily abortion and inflation, when they cast their Senate ballots this fall, not the character of the candidates. Wren says this election is going to be decided by national trends. The candidates are not going to break through all of a sudden and make people say, yes, that's the kind of leadership we need, based on their character. That is the Republican, that, plus the fact that North Carolina usually elects Republican senators, and the historical pattern of the president's party losing ground in midterm elections means that Bud doesn't need to worry too much about humanizing himself, says Gary Pierce, a longtime Democratic political strategist. That's the Republican strategy. They don't want to make public appearances. They don't want the media to cover them. They want to do it all under the surface. While Bud has hosted a handful of meet and greets, they have been few and far between. Because his campaign won't add me to their press list, I haven't known where to show up. So when he finally makes a well-publicized appearance at a Trump rally, no less, you can be sure I don't miss it. It's a warm September morning, and Sherry Beasley is perched on a picnic table bench at Durham's largest open-air produce market, seated within arm's reach of nearly every farmer who showed up to her Agriculture Center roundtable event. Dressed in an all-denim outfit and sporting a dainty gold necklace that says Protect Roe, Beasley hasn't said a word in 40 minutes, allowing as much time as possible for attendees to share their stories and struggles. The farmers are diverse, with operations that range from tobacco fields to modular containers of microgreens, but they share many of the same stressors: rising fuel and fertilizer prices, dwindling yields due to a hostile and unpredictable climate, land loss and encroaching development, and, for the table's five black farmers, the persistence of systemic discrimination in the agriculture industry. A few hours after the event, Beasley sends out an email with a detailed list of agriculture-related legislative goals that she will fight for if elected to the United States Senate: expanding access to capital and crop insurance, and helping farmers adopt climate-smart techniques, to name a few. But while she's there, excepting the 2 minutes when she repeats back of summaries she's heard, she stays quiet. She nods, holds eye contact, and files each attendee's words into her mental Rolodex, later using their perspective to formulate a course of action. It's a master class in judicial temperament, which makes sense because Beasley is a judge. A 1991 graduate of the University of Tennessee College of Law, Beasley spent several years as a public defender in Cumberland County before rising through the ranks of the state's judicial system, serving first as a state district court judge and later on the bench of the North Carolina Court of Appeals and the North Carolina Supreme Court. In May, after reviewing dozens of cases Beasley heard in the appellate court, the assembly esteemed her to be, quote, a judge who is independent and hard to label, adding that lawyers who appeared before her, as well as some former colleagues, describe her as thorough, fair, and even-handed. Patricia Timmons Goodson, a retired North Carolina Supreme Court justice who worked alongside Beasley for nearly the entirety of her career, shared similar sentiments with Indy. Timmons Goodman recalled a 2009 case heard by Beasley in the appellate court, which asks whether the age and mental status of a juvenile suspect is relevant when deciding whether the suspect has been held in police custody, and thus when deciding whether the suspect was entitled to their Miranda rights. The case centered around a 13-year-old special education student who had been held and interrogated by police who did not redeem his Miranda rights in a school conference room. Beasley was the lone dissenter, arguing that it was absurd to employ the same definition of custody, regardless of whether the individual was 8 or 38 years old. The case ultimately reached the United States Supreme Court, which concurred with Beasley's ruling. Timmons Goodman says, "That's an example of how well she knows and understands the Constitution. She is independent and bold, even if in the face of colleagues who say, 'That's not the way I see it.'" Her decades of experience and proven ability to win statewide elections made her a popular pick in the May primary, where she trounced her 10 opponents with 81% of the vote. Since then, Beasley has upheld her pledge not to accept any corporate PAC money, relying on record-setting surge of second-quarter donations, likely driven in part by the overturn of Roe v. Wade, to fund her campaign. Her ads emphasize she is not a Washington insider, but an impartial judge who has held dangerous offenders accountable in North Carolina and will do the same in Congress. Wren, the Republican strategist, views Beasley's advertising campaign as more effective than her opponent's. He says, "I don't agree with Beasley, but she comes across to me as a person. Bud talks like a politician, and I think that's not good." Along with his grocery store promos, Bud has launched a slew of attack ads that portray Beasley as soft on crime and bereft of the support of law enforcement. As a refute and an appeal to moderate voters, Beasley has touted the support of current and retired law enforcement officers and voiced opposition to the defund the police movement at multiple campaign events. Timmons Goodson says she also observed Beasley to be tough in the courtroom and sees Beasley as an ally to police, provided that police are on the right side of the law, saying if law enforcement is in the right and they've done their job as they're called to do it, she's right there with them. At the same time, if it has not dotted its I's and crossed its T's, she's going to be strong enough and bold enough to say, "Ooh, didn't quite get here on that one." A few weeks after the Farmer Roundtable, I catch Beasley at a recreation center in Fayetteville, where she's speaking to community members about the fundamental freedoms at stake in the upcoming election. In an empty conference room, Beasley tells me about her faith, which she calls the foundation of her service, and shares memories of her mother, an activist, an educator who served as the first black dean at Austin Peay State University in Tennessee. Quote, "We were all told the 2020 election was the most important election of our lifetimes. But if my late mother were here, she would tell us that every election is the most important election of our lifetimes." In our one-on-one conversation, Beasley is as warm and attentive as she was with the farmers in Durham. And when she takes the podium at the rec center, she has the ability to command a room. Bearing no script, she delivers a fiery, well-structured monologue about the importance of expanding access to health care, allocating resources to educators, combating the climate crisis, and protecting reproductive freedoms. "We have to feel a sense of urgency in this election," she says. "We must." The crowd of residents and elected officials, many of whom know her personally, is exhilarated and responsive, offering Beasley a near-constant smattering of applause and punctuating most of her statements with a "that's right" or an "amen." Every time she says her opponent's name, the elderly woman next to me giggles and whispers, "Ted Butt, B-U-T-T, Butt." "Ted Budd has been in Congress for 6 years," Beasley concludes, "so we don't have to wonder what he will do. When people show you who they are," in unison the crowd finishes, "we believe them." The N-word. You know what the N-word is? My partner, Aaron, and I stare at the TV in our Wilmington hotel room, horrified but relieved that we left that Trump rally before its headliner took the stage. We're at a Comfort Inn, a few miles away from the Aero Center, where Trump is speaking, watching his address on C-SPAN. "No, no, no," Trump says quickly, likely to quell folks in the crowd yelling the slur. "It's the nuclear word." He was lamenting Putin's recent threat to use nuclear weapons in a war against the Ukraine, a war that wouldn't have happened had Trump remained president. After spewing his usual lies and racist remarks for more than 40 minutes, Trump finally mentions Bud, calling the congressman rock solid on defending our borders and vowing he will represent you long and hard. Ted's running against a weak-on-crime left-wing extremist named Cherry Beasley. She was a judge, Cherry Beasley was. She was a Marxist radical. Pierce, the Democratic strategist, tells me the North Carolina elections are always about race. Racist rhetoric is the easiest way to scare swing voters, he says. In this year's Senate contest, Republicans are centering their fear tactics around weak-on-crime Beasley, who, if elected, would become North Carolina's first black senator, as well as the migrant invasion and the non-issue of public schools teaching critical race theory, according to Pierce. In past elections, the state GOP has launched similar campaigns about affirmative action and voter ID laws, he says. Shortly after North Carolina's 1984 Senate race, the one where Republican candidate Jesse Helms famously triumphed after using white hands to argue that white people were losing job opportunities to racial quotas, Pierce says he conducted a poll to reveal which issue had most accurately predicted the way that voters cast their ballots. When he looked at whether or not voters supported making Martin Luther King Jr. Day a federal holiday, Pierce says he was able to predict their Senate votes with nearly 100% accuracy. It's all about race. One word, it's all about race, and Trump has made it even more about race. Indeed, when my partner and I arrive at the procession of vendor and volunteer booths stationed outside the Aero Center, we see ralliers dressed in shirts that say things like civil warning and white privilege, a false political ideology created to cultivate division. It doesn't take long for someone to say the N-word within earshot. Aaron, who is black, describes his rally experience as a strange combination of invisibility and tokenism, where the dozen volunteers who approach me act like he's not there. The one time someone does talk to him is to explain that critical race theory is a form of racism. But a few seconds after walking away, volunteers surreptitiously try to catch him in the backgrounds of their photos to store in their arsenal, we surmise, in case someone accuses them of being racist. After waiting in line for 4 hours, we finally pass through the white, high-peaked security tents, a proverbial hood and cloaking, if you will. And in another case of probable tokenism, someone from Trump's security team hastily pulls out of the crowd and seats us on the bleachers behind the speaker's platform. Before Bud speaks, we hear from a handful of other state GOP incumbents and hopefuls like Beau Hines, who riles up the crowd by condemning men competing in women's athletics, and U.S. Representative David Rauser, who underscores the need for voter ID laws and a parent's Bill of Rights. Education should be about learning, Rauser says, not liberal indoctrination and sexual perversion designed to destroy the family structure so critical to a civil society. When Bud takes a stand clad in a Navy suit and an American flag pin, he quickly proves to be less charismatic than each of the previous speakers, including a 27-year-old Hines who has zero political experience. With frequent glances at his script, Bud delivers a halting, watered-down version of the speeches we've already heard, talking mostly about inflation, Biden's incompetence, and Beasley's judicial record. Every time he says Beasley's name, the crowd chants, "Lock her up!" The woman sitting next to me is Debbie Love, the second vice chair of the new Hanover County GOP. She has only good things to say about Bud, Bud's son used to go to her church, and she occasionally saw Bud when he joined his son for services. He comes into the back of the church, Love says about Bud. He doesn't want anybody to know who he is. He just wants to come and worship. She calls Bud an honorable man, but later clarifies she doesn't have a personal relationship with him. It's an observational relationship, she says. That seems to be the case with everyone. A few hours later, even Trump admits that Bud is an enigma. Trump says, the congressman, they all called and said, can you do us a favor? Can you endorse Ted Budd? I said, I hear he's good. Tell me about him. A lot of people don't know him. In Love's telling, it seems like Bud doesn't want anybody to know who he is. This, I think, is because Bud is uncomfortable with himself. After months spent distancing himself from Trump, Bud took the stage with the former president and shouted, Make America Great Again! After proclaiming his support for farmers, veterans, and child abuse victims, he votes and behaves in ways that work against them. And after more than a decade of selling firearms, he says that Beasley is the one abetting criminals. To close his speech at the Trump rally, Bud touts his adherence to his family mottos. Just do what you say you're going to do. That's how I've operated throughout my life, Bud says. That's how I've served in the U.S. Congress, and that's the kind of U.S. senator that I'm going to be. After he says it, he inhales, holds his breath, and frowns like maybe he knows it's not true. Well, let's move in the remaining 5 minutes or 6 minutes or so that I have to go to some arts. Byron Woods on stage has penned this article, New Room. As any stage manager will tell you, the real drama is always offstage. Such was the case at the start of a roaring fall season here when 39 separate productions over its first 3 weeks pushed local venues to their capacity. But that triumph came just as the area's itinerant theater and dance companies, the groups with no rehearsal or performance space of their own, which constitute more than two-thirds of the region's performing arts community, got a nasty shock. As the Indy reported last week, three prominent venues either closed or signaled that they were cutting back, a move that left the largest demographic group in live arts here with even fewer places and opportunities to show their work. Then, in a Shakespearean plot twist, four venues across the area began stepping up to give stage artists a place where they can be seen, and audiences a place to come for live theater and dance. As we talk, Jack Wrights surveys his surroundings with a bemused eye. A 1,600-square-foot cube inside the warehouse building at Golden Belt, nestled between High Wire Brewing, Urban Tales Veterinary Hospital, and Cugino Forno. At the moment, the decor around a mid-room cherry picker poised to hang theatrical light and sound rigging is not industrial. Sheetrock and construction dust coat the floor. A table filled with blueprints, pizza boxes and coffee cups, and stacks of carpet squares and uninstalled bathroom fixtures off to one side. Still, Wrights is confident that by late October, the 60-seat theater will be ready for a soft opening as the new space for the award-winning improvisational comedy collective Mettlesome. That in itself is a welcome change of fortune for a group including founder Ashley Meltzer and comedians April Dudash, Lauren Foster Lee, Jonathan Yeomans, and Hilary Yance, who'd schlepped a truck full of chairs to venues across the region before a year-long residency at the late Great Gear Street co-working space of the Mothership. Wrights recalls, programming that space for a full year taught us that we were able to do this. Then when we went dark for the pandemic, there was not a doubt that we would be back. Over 200 patrons contributed $41,500 to a Kickstarter fundraiser to build a theater for Mettlesome, which the group supplemented with savings it had accrued since its start. Golden Belt Property Management also chipped in on the upfitting necessary to make the new digs a functional performance space. When it opens, Mettlesome will present signature company acts, including Hush Hush and Golden Years, as well as a selection of local improv comedy troupes on Friday and Saturday nights. It'll also hold regional theater and dance groups. After opening, the company is installing a sprung floor to accommodate dance makers as well as other stage artists. Bulldog Ensemble Players, an edgy group with a taste for present-day scripts, will stage an urban comedy called The Garbologists at Mettleson on November 3rd through 13. And choreographers Alyssa Noble and Chris Strauss from Beriskel Dance Theater will produce Recital, an odd, original variety show of embodied performances, the weekend of November 18th and 19th. Wrights goes on, so many of the Triangle's artworks are siloed. We're really hoping we have a space where artists of different disciplines can come and show each other their work in a way that's inspiring for everybody. We're hungry to host other artists. Now, it appears that I'm going to run way out of time before finishing this article, and just want to mention that the article, which is available, of course, in print and on IndieWeek.com, are Mettleson, the Theater Raleigh Arts Center, that's theaterraleigh.com, Mettleson is thisismettleson.com, Back to One Acting Studio, backtooneactingstudio.com, and Lanza's Cafe, which right now is on Facebook as Lanza's Cafe. And I will curtail that article just to mention there are a couple articles still that I didn't get to, and one was a very short one featuring a woman named Eileen Butler, who's president of the North American Guild of Change Ringers, whose members meet this week at Christ Church in Raleigh. Should I tell you what change ringers do? I don't think so. I'll wait. They involve, well, they do. They involve teams of people sitting up in cold belfries, pulling on ropes to ring bells in specific patterns, depending on what they're attempting to do and how many bells there are. Some of these pattern ringing the changes could last overnight. I'll just put it that way. And this woman gives quite a little brief talk about herself and the club, more or less, she's in. So that's change ringing. And speaking of music, I was going to say, I've decided, because of interest of time, that we will not be hearing from our musical group to play the closing theme song, but they were called Bless Their Hearts. Well, we're going to hear from them anyway. So long, everybody.